You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Setlist, we'll hear from the Iowa singer-songwriter Lissy, who stopped by the WPR studio to play a set of songs from her latest album and talk about her renewed passion for making music on her own terms. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, from the latest court action on Wisconsin voting laws to the federal government's big cheese. Robert Menster is back with us. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start, Rob, with voting in Wisconsin. We've seen a lot of back and forth in the courts about various voting laws in Wisconsin. A voter ID gets a lot of the attention, but there's news this week about early voting. What happened in the courts?
Yeah, we have talked about the sort of the whiplash-inducing on-again, off-again rulings on voter ID. And in fact, it's worth mentioning just this afternoon, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court has refused to reinstate the voter ID law. And so that's the latest breaking news this afternoon, that it looks like voter ID will indeed be in place for November. But on early voting, we got what certainly looks like a definitive final answer earlier this week, and that is early voting is on. There had been a law passed by Wisconsin Republicans that early voting couldn't start until October 24th. And that was thrown out as part of the ruling in July that also upheld some of the voter ID requirements. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel appealed that, and on Monday he lost that appeal, and on Tuesday he said he would not be taking that any further. So that is that. You can go vote early.
And that's for this election. He was looking for a stay pending further consideration. Is that right?
Right. That's right. That's exactly. And so that's for this election. Early voting is something that takes some pressure off of polling places on election day, especially given the long lines that we saw in the presidential primary. This is, it may well be the case that this makes it easier to vote for people who maybe don't have such flexible work hours or who have trouble getting out on Tuesday. And of course, the other big thing that that early voting does is it allows sort of committed partisan activists to hold early voting events to vote themselves and then drive around on election day and do get out the vote stuff.
As I understand it, this law didn't just affect when early voting could start, but also where it could happen. It limited municipalities to one early voting site, which part of the challenge was, well, if you're talking about a larger city, especially like, say, Milwaukee, that's restrictive, the plaintiff said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are a lot of rural places where there is one polling place. It's pretty obvious that in a larger city, that's not the case. And so, there were a number of things: the time limits and no voting the weekend before the election, and restrictions on in-person absentee ballots. It all sort of winnowed down the opportunities to cast these votes outside of election day, and a lot of that stuff is now thrown out.
So with all the back and forth, Rob, let me make sure I've got it right here. Voter ID, yes, we need voter ID to vote in November's elections. And cities, municipalities, whatever, can have early voting starting in September at the sites of their choosing.
That's right. Some places like Milwaukee and Madison, the largest cities, have said that they're likely to begin early voting probably in the last week of September. Not every place has it all set up, and different cities, different municipalities have some leeway on when they'll do that. But we're going to start to get details on that now that we have clarity on the law.
Pending some really big court surprise, but probably now it's too late for that.
Who knows, right? Yeah.
We're talking to Rob Menster from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin this week. And Rob, another story you've been watching, a lot of the country has been watching, the story of the defendants featured in the Making a Murderer Netflix series. Some news today on Stephen Avery, some new tests that his lawyer wants. But his nephew, Brendan Dassey, had his conviction overturned, maybe released or headed to a new trial. And you've been watching, I know, the reaction to this. What are you seeing this week?
Yes, we saw the we heard in the news at the top of the hour the claims made by Stephen Avery's lawyer and the process that they're engaging in. But to me, what may be more interesting or may end up having more impact are ripple effects from the Brendan Dassey case. Of course, Dassey was convicted of being a party to he was convicted of murder for being a party to Avery's crime, and Dassey was just 16 at the time of the murder. And for those millions of people who were captivated by the Netflix series Making a Murderer, those sequences, that's some of the hardest parts to watch were the interrogations of Dassey, because he was so young and because he had some mental limitations and he clearly didn't understand what was going on in cases. So that's why it was on exactly those grounds that his conviction was overturned, and now prosecutors have to decide whether or not they're going to retry him. So what we saw this week, at any rate, a couple of our USA Today Network Wisconsin reporters surveyed some experts in juvenile justice. There was one of the policy changes that at least one expert saw potentially coming of this could be a requirement that juveniles have a lawyer present during interrogation. That is a key part of what the judge said in this case. And so with the conviction overturned in a high-profile case, it could be that this ends up having some impact.
Yeah, so a lot of what I think attracted people to this series was the particulars of the case. But this could lead to wider policy changes, legal changes, as you say, when it comes to young suspects, interrogations, and legal representation. This could have a spill-out effect way beyond this particular case.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the prosecutors may retry Dassey. He may be convicted again. We don't know what will happen, but I do think that it's the sort of message that gets heard when something that has this much attention on it gets overturned.
We'll keep on watching that. I know you will. And finally, the federal government is buying cheese, lots and lots of cheese. I think the number I saw was 11 million pounds of cheese. What's going on, Rob?
Yeah, we may have overdone it with the cheese. So back in May, the Wall Street Journal reported that there was so much surplus cheese in America that every man, woman, and child in the country would need to eat an extra 3 pounds this year to work through that surplus, which I say, listen, I think we can do it. Who says Americans can't set big goals and achieve them? I think we can band together and eat those 3 pounds of cheese. But this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that it would buy $20 million worth of cheese, distributed to food pantries, food banks around the country. And the idea is that this will help to boost prices for dairy farmers and keep excess stores of cheese from going to waste, which is what is bound to happen.
And then, and then the markets, the foreign markets, might pick back up and reduce this glut, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so the U.S. dollar is high right now, and so it's less attractive to foreign markets, and Europe is producing more milk, so that also is eating into U.S. exports. So, these things are cyclical. The reason that there's a glut now is because people increased production when there was a higher demand. So it could come back, but yeah, it shows. This year at least, and for the last couple years, dairy producers have overshot.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Rob Metzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin.